So when we're ready to go, we're going to smack that big red button. This one here.
Okay. I'm going to do a test run.
Yeah, do
it. Can test. I stop it
yeah.
if I hit?
Yeah. Oh, God, that's beautiful.
And then you'd be talking away.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Empty Promise Podcast. It's almost like we were just listening to a podcast. And then your finger slipped. Yeah. Oh, no. Where are we? Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Empty Promise Podcast. My name is Chris, and today you are joining me and my best friend in the whole wide world, Mr. James D. Downey.
Hello.
On what is episode 129 of the podcast.
I like the way you did that. Pause. 129.
Yeah.
Not 100 and. Because no. We don't have time for that. We don't have time. I know we've lost that time explaining it, but...
But I get that. No, yeah. I get what you're going for there. We don't have time.
Are you going to be one of those people who... You know, whenever you're saying the date of something, you don't do the tth or nth anymore. What so it's not December 22nd or December 3rd. It's December 3.
No, I'm never that person.
December 22.
No, I'm never that person.
Get ready for Christmas, December 25.
No.
They do it in movie trailers.
Yeah, I know. That. Yeah, I've heard that before. That's
pisses
strange.
Me off so much.
Coming December 3.
What? You sound like you're missing a couple of brain cells. It sounds like it was hit in the head.
Yeah.
And then was just thrown into a recording booth, much like us.
Yeah, this morning. That's how it happens. Dee, thank you for joining me here on episode 129, where today we'll let the people know what's going to happen. Because this is kind of what we do on a weekly basis. When we do this on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
One of us goes away and researches something that interests us, and then we kind of bring that report and tell the other person.
Yeah.
And the other person doesn't necessarily know what this report is going to be.
Yeah, I'm completely blind this week.
So today I've done my research on something that I find super interesting. It's crept its way back into the news recently. So we might touch on that towards the end, but it's not really that part that we're going to be focused on. I'll tell you what, I'll just read you out a little snippet. Here, this is an advertisement, an old advertisement, and you tell me what you think. And this is going to lead us into our topic.
Okay.
For the day.
Oh, that's this. I'm intrigued.
Okay. Here we go. Man wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success.
Whoa.
Do you know what this is?
It's a bad advertisement is what it is.
Right?
I'm not saying right for that. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like Ron Swanson, putting an ad in the paper.
Yeah, wanted. Yeah. Girl. Yeah.
That's wild, hey?
Yeah. So that was the advertisement that was brought in 1914, I believe.
Oh, is it Everest?
No, it's not Everest.
It was earlier than that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's interesting. So low wages...
Hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful.
Is it the North or South Pole?
You're getting warmer.
Getting colder.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get it, I don't think.
No?
Let me know, Chris.
This is the journey, or expedition, field expedition, of Sir Ernest Shackleton.
Oh!
And the Endurance.
Nearly to the South Pole.
Yes, no. Kind yes. of. But more so, everybody knows, well, if people who are listening, if anybody's ever heard of the Arctic expedition that Sir Ernest Shackleton went on and the kind of failure that it was, but not really, because the story I'm going to bring today is the kind of...
The hidden truth.
Yeah, the triumph that came from a field expedition, if that makes sense. But I don't want to talk about Sir Ernest because he gets all the credit in this. But today we're going to talk about his actual captain, Sir Frank Worsley, who was the real unsung hero.
Oh, I like that.
Of the Endurance.
I could.
That a lot of people don't really know about. And that's the story I'm going to bring today.
Because I've heard Shackleton, but I haven't heard...
Everybody's heard Shackleton. Sir Ernest Shackleton. A little bit in Sir Ernest Shackleton before we begin... He's Irish.
Is he?
Originally Irish, I think.
I guess that does sound Irish.
Yeah. Yeah. Born into a big family. I did this report and I didn't actually get any notes on his early life.
Well, okay.
But he had a brother, Frank or Francis Shackleton, who was actually one of the men who was wanted or not wanted, but under question for the theft of the Irish crown jewels back in like 1903, I think it was.
I didn't know that there were Irish crown jewels.
Exactly, that's another big topic.
These Shackletons, this is an interesting family.
Yeah, interesting. I think they were originally from somewhere else and maybe they moved to Ireland, or maybe he was born in Ireland. No, he was born in Ireland. And then obviously they moved. Now, Shackleton was already a big kind of explorer, and before this expedition came about, and Frank Worsley was already a pretty recognized captain in the world of seafaring at the time.
Okay.
And he and Ernest Shackleton met in 1914, but beforehand Frank Worsley had previously known of Shackleton because Shackleton had made a field expedition to the South Pole in 1909. It didn't go according to plan. Now, he was just Ernest Shackleton at that point. He had made a...
no, sir.
Yeah, he had made it. They tried to make a trek to the... They got within a whisker of the South Pole in 1909. And whenever he came back, he was knighted then.
Is that the story of where they got like really, really, really close but had to turn back? And then like a couple of months or years later, a different party went and did it?
No, I think you're thinking... Are you thinking of Robert Scott?
I am. He died.
He died.
Okay, so Shackleton did not die on the South
Pole. Shackleton didn't die on the South Pole. He had been to Antarctica twice before, and once a whisker within the South Pole. So the South Pole, Antarctica is like its own big kind of continent, but the South Pole is like the bit that's like right in the middle, is complete polar opposite to the North Pole, essentially. He got within a whisker of it, didn't make it, came back, he was knighted. Hugely ambitious guy, really kind of big ego. Huge big ego. Press at the time loved him. He was keen adventurer, and when he hired men, he did so. It was said that he did so kind of just completely off gut instinct. So you would come into a room with Shackleton, you'd sit down, kind of like what we're doing now, and if he liked you based upon not necessarily like credentials or whether you had traveled before, but if he liked your personality, that's how he would hire you. And
he's like an eccentric kind of dude.
Super eccentric dude, like really over the top eccentric dude. Worsley, this guy that we're going to talk about, Frank Worsley, he was already a kind of really exuberant kind of guy. Like he had loads of like a big history with sea expeditions. He had 25 years experience at sea. He had already sailed most of the major oceans at that time. Now remember, this is back whenever we're sailing in like wooden boats, like wooden, you know, like ships, wooden ships with...
Well, yeah, is this with like under the power of wind, or like do we have engines at this point?
No, this is mainly under the power of wind.
Okay.
Yeah, this is sea, this is that kind of seafaring, I believe.
Swashbuckling.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's not much of that, you know.
So Shackleton hired Frank Worsley there and then as the captain of the ship. And the plan for this expedition was to set sail off of Argentina, so South America, right at the very bottom. I didn't even know Argentina was at the bottom of South America before I did this report.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I always thought South America eludes me. I have no idea what's going on.
The mysterious continent.
Yeah. I know the places that are there. I just don't know where they are.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So they set off from South Argentina, right down at the very bottom. And they're... plan was to collect supplies from a whaling station on a South Georgia island. So South Georgia is kind of off Argentina then, so it'd be eastern from Argentina if we look at a map, I think. And then from there they'd sail on to the Antarctic coast, right down at the bottom. From there then a team of six men would attempt to be the first to traverse Antarctica by way of the pole.
So to go directly in a straight line across it?
Straight line across it, yeah. So they're basically
going twice as far as going to the pole itself. Pole,
yeah, they're going to get to the pole and then they're going to come straight across the top. Fuck. So from one side, basically, if we're talking Ireland, we're going from like Malin Head to like right down to like whatever that place is in Cork, the very bottom of Ireland.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
So that's the way they're going to go. Another ship would then land around on the west coast of Antarctica at the Ross Sea side, and they would leave provisions there for the second part of the trek, so the men wouldn't have to take everything with them. Now back then Antarctica was like known as like the next great frontier. It was just a huge unknown and loads of men wanted to do it. They wanted to be explored. Amundsen was the first guy to do it in 1911, and Scott got there in 1912, but he died. That's the guy you're thinking of?
Yeah, yeah.
And he died, whenever he died, he was found in like a shack, in like a, it's called like Scott's Shack or something. I think it could be right at the South Pole. It's still there today, because people who track it still use Scott's Shack, and they found his diary entries and stuff. He obviously, I don't know what that story was in its entirety. I think maybe he just ran out of food and provisions, maybe?
I think, yeah, because I think they made it to the pole, and then on the way back, they ran out. I think he was one of like the few, like one of the ones who got the furthest, but not obviously the whole way.
Okay, okay. So they needed a ship, the SEAL, and the ship that they acquired was called the Endurance. Now, they did so through like funding, what do you call that? Like, you know, when you go on a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, if I go to do something nowadays, like a big adventure, I need funding from...
They ran a GoFundMe page?
That's exactly what they did. GoFund Sir Ernest. No, it's like a, you know, when like big wealthy businessmen...
Oh, like a sponsor?
Like a sponsor. Like, they relied heavily on sponsorship, yeah. But there's a word for it. I can't think of the word.
Endorsement?
Could be endorsement. No, that's more political, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it wasn't endorsement. There's a word on it. I can't think of what it was.
I'm thinking of Bruce Wayne and Batman talking to Dart Harvey Dent, and he says, one of these things for me, and you'll never need another cent in your life.
That's it.
And I'm like,
that's what they need to
one
do.
One fundraiser? Fundraiser sounds more charity. It is a kind of fundraiser, but it's more for like, it's like for rich people, basically, to get attached to this cool project.
Pretty much. That's exactly what it was. Yeah. And a little side note, but after this... No, actually, I'll not ruin it. Anyway, they acquired a boat called the Endurance, and Worsley writes that he had never sailed a pluckier vessel. So it was, this was the peak at the time, so that a lot of money went into this vessel. And on October 26th, their journey started in 1914. They set off from Buenos Aires, Argentina, and on board was an Australian photographer and filmmaker called Frank Hurley. Now, thanks to Frank Hurley, even nowadays, if you look it up, you can still see the actual footage, like proper film reel and still images of the men on board the HMS Endurance. And you know, it's thanks to him nowadays that we have a lot of the, you know, we can piece together a lot of what happened on this expedition. Worsley from that time was right underneath Shackleton. Shackleton was the top man, and everybody knew him on board the ship as the boss. But unfortunately, Shackleton, like many top bosses, didn't really have the people skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was head honcho, but he didn't necessarily... Frank Worsley was able to talk to the men, direct the men, command the men. Shackleton was kind of just like... He seen kind of everybody almost as beneath him.
Oh, okay.
You know, that kind of way? Like, this is my expedition. You're just here to help me.
You're here to facilitate it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Whereas Worsley was one rubbing shoulders with the men, getting stuck in, getting down and dirty.
So he was like running the ship, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
But under the direction of Shackleton.
That
makes sense, I think.
Now, Shackleton was a smart boy as well, because he knew as well, sorry, going back to Hurley, that that having images and having film... was key, because if he was able to come back with this, all these big endorsements and sponsors would be like, well, geez, look at these expeditions. Let's give this guy more money. And he was able to, when he recruited the men, basically, he was able to gather around the men who had the talents that he himself didn't have. So he basically filled his ship with men who could do things that he didn't either didn't want to or couldn't. Mm-hmm. He's still a very intelligent man, super intelligent man, not to take that away from him. The focus of it, so 5,000 men originally applied.
Whoa. Yes. Okay, so this is, so this unpopular ad actually was very popular.
Very popular, very popular, now, I don't know if it was very popular because at that time, 1914, didn't the war that just broke out?
It did happen, it did break out in 1914, but I cannot remember what month.
It ended in November, didn't it? The Great War.
It's 3 years of history for you. Yeah, it ended in November of 1918.
Yeah. August or something, wasn't it?
Aye. Go for it.
Either way, the war had started. So maybe these men who applied were thinking, you know, this could be a way to kind of get out of the war, you know, this war effort.
Maybe.
I'm not sure. Like, I'm completely speculating on that one. But 5,000 men applied. Shackleton only hired 26.
Okay.
So it's quite a drop.
Cream of the crop.
He hired 26. There was also one stowaway. That we might touch on a wee bit later. So one man, an 18-year-old actually just hid in a locker on board the ship. There was two pigs, 69 Canadian sled dogs. And that's it. That's everything they took, along with all their food and water and all everything that they needed. It took 11 days to sail from Buenos Aires to a Norwegian whaling station in South Georgia. It was a super harsh place with a smell of blood and blubber permeated the air. Big whaling station, so they literally killed whales, cut them up and fed them to whatever, or shipped them off. I don't know what they need. But they stopped there and they purchased 2 tons of whale meat. That's quite a lot of whale meat. That would help sustain both man and dog in the months to come. It was early summer, but it was a whole lot colder than usual. And when they got to South Georgia, the Norwegians warned Shackleton that the ice conditions to the south were the worst that they had ever seen.
Shit.
So from South Georgia down to Antarctica, they had never seen ice the way it was. And they advised him strongly not to go. But despite the whaler's advice and Shackleton being who he was, he gave the order to set sail on December 5th, 1914. And at first it seemed that the whaler's warnings had been unfounded, because for 3 days the conditions were super favourable. They made plenty of progress, and then 1,000 miles further north than expected, they started running into the ice fields.
Shit.
So these ice fields weren't supposed to hit to a thousand miles. Yeah. 1,000 miles.
What?
Yeah, further north. So this ice was drifting, and it was pack ice, called pack ice. You picture big, massive sheets of ice, maybe 2-3 foot in depth, that just floating in the ice. So
I'm thinking, like, you know those massive ships they have, like icebreaker ships that are designed to, like, that's the type of stuff they're going through right now.
Exactly, that is, that's exactly the type of stuff.
But I'm guessing, but they don't have a big icebreaker ship.
No, they do not.
They have a little plucky.
By any rational analysis, the decision to push on into the Weddell Sea, so this is the Weddell Sea is the sea between South Georgia and Antarctica, it was ludicrous. All signs were against them, and even the Norwegian whalers told them before they set off, it's crazy, you will not make it, like it's a suicide mission to do this. Worsley, who is the captain, Frank Worsley, the captain who we're talking about today, he advised Shackleton many times. He was like, I don't think we should do this. But he was already a super experienced sailor. He kind of knew what he was up against. But at the end of the day, Shackleton's word was final. He said, we're pushing on, we're pushing on. But he was desperate actually to get away, because at this time it was coming out that Shackleton was actually openly having an affair back home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he was also... his brother was implicated in the fraud that he was doing later. So
that's right.
Basically, things were going to hell in a handbasket back home to Shackleton. So he didn't want to turn and go home. Like, he had nothing really to go home to. He just wanted to play on. Yeah. He wanted to make a big name.
Make his name good again. Do something heroic.
Yeah. So Hurley, this other guy, Hurley, continued to capture the footage of all the ice. And we were traveling through a city of ice. Some of the bergs were miles wide and loomed like white castles. Negotiating a route through the pack was taking its toll, and we began to fall well behind schedule. That's coming from Captain Frank Worsley. Now, the continental crossing could only be achieved in the Antarctic summer, which is where they were at the moment. This was summertime. But rather than making landfall at the first opportunity, Shackleton wanted to push as far south as he could to shorten the trek. So instead of just coming down onto the north tip of Antarctica as planned, he wanted to push well down the south coast to shorten the trip as much as possible. And then 60 miles before they were due to stop, progress halted altogether. Shackleton's dream to cross the continent kind of got in the way of safety as such, and he kept pushing into the ice, and basically it sealed the fate of the Endurance, because the pack ice closed in around the Endurance, and the Endurance was literally
the ice could smell blood
stuck. Yeah, pretty much stuck, completely stuck. This huge big ship, and it was completely packed in. They could see no water in any direction, no matter where you looked. It was just ice, big, massive, big. Like, we're talking in terms of the length of these things. Like, some of them could have been like a quarter of a mile long. These packs of ice, huge, big things. But Worsley never criticized Shackleton once for getting them into this terrible situation. He was always willing to kind of see things in a more positive light. His logbook actually wrote, let me get it here. We lie 2 for a while to see if the pack will open at all or when this northeasterly wind ceases. But it did not open. So basically what they're waiting for is waiting for the ice to open for them, the seawater, and then get back into sailing. Now Shackleton never actually admitted to just how serious the situation was, and a month later open water was spotted in the distance, and a huge effort was made by every man on board. So they were stuck there for a month. And a huge effort was made by every man on board to get off, and they used these big massive like ice picks and wooden logs to start breaking through the ice, and the ship started moving ever so slowly, but the ice was much too thick to penetrate, and they were forced to abandon. They only moved feet, and they were forced to abandon again, and the ice just completely glued in once again and completely stuck around them. And
So they've already extended their trip by a month.
By a month.
Being stuck in the ice, basically.
Now, when they pause here and they know we're going to be stuck here, this is a case of they're going to be... They have to wait for the ice to shift, which is more than likely going to be next year.
Oh, right.
They got to wait till the summer, the Arctic summer, the Antarctic summer ends. The ice shifts and we see water again, so... Could be waiting for the guts of a year. They have it in their minds. We could be waiting for the guts of a year here before this... For this,
when did they leave again for this?
They left in December.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, that's like the middle of the summer there.
Yeah.
So they're coming to the end of the summer now, basically. Yeah. Shit.
So they confirmed Ernest and Frank confirmed what everybody already knew, that the any hope of crossing the Arctic continent was gone. Mm-hmm. This was now a survival kind of expedition. That all our focus had to be on how are we going to survive until this ice clears, that we can set sail again and get back to land. It was super important to Shackleton that he brought all 26 of these men home, not only for himself, but like we talked about before, that sponsorship. And nobody wanted a field expedition, and these millionaires who were paying this money for ships didn't want to be seen endorsing
A field
expedition,
a massive failure,
where another 26 men are going to die in the Weddell Sea. You know,
that's interesting. The way the photographer being there is like a double-edged sword, because you know, if 26 men go and die, and that's kind of like, that's sad. 26 men went and died, but if 26 men go and die, and there's pictures of them and there's video of them all the work that they were doing, it's like it plays well in the news, kind of thing, and it just brings so much more attention to it.
Yeah,
and like. Yeah, obviously it would be a spectacular failure compared to just a tragedy, because of all the publicity around it.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild.
But Shackleton was again a smart boy, and he knew that he needed the films that Frank Hurley was taking and the pictures that Frank Hurley was taking, even if it was the men they decided to dig in, basically, but he needed those to get home because he needed money, and when he got home he needed that money from the pictures. It was a very ambitious project, and Shackleton now was brainstorming on what way things were going to go, basically, where we're going to go, and he came up with a very ambitious project to walk 1800 miles across mostly uncharted territory in the hope of finding, in the hope of getting to land and moving from there, and the hope of getting, I think, to the top of Antarctica and being able then to sail. Or they were going to move 1800 miles across uncharted territory with boats, as far as I know. They were going to take their lifeboats with them for the 1800 miles, set sail from the top coast of Antarctica and sail back to the whaling station in South Georgia.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that was it. Now, I could be wrong. I have it in my notes, but I'm kind of flicking through from different notes to different note here. I took these from several sources, D, because I'm trying to paint like a full picture of what was going on. But basically, Frank Worsley was now the captain of what he called a floating hotel. Okay. And they christened it the Ritz, after the fancy hotel in London at the time where all these men kind of came from. We would settle in for the winter and sail home in the spring. That was the plan. The men threw themselves into the task required to sustain a life on the ice. Everybody pitched in regardless of rank. They collected snow for drinking and bathing. They hunted seals and penguins to keep themselves fed, and toiled to keep the Endurance clean. Life was busy and even comfortable. Situations were desperate, but every man put on a brave face and pretended otherwise. There were many diversions. They listened to gramophone records in the evening. They played games and held debates about books that they were reading. And Hurley, the photographer, gave a few lantern talks at night. So basically he just stood up and just talked about random stuff, yeah, whatever was going on, you know what I mean? Maybe things that he had seen or filmed or so, I don't know. True. And every Saturday night, the men toasted their sweethearts, wives, and loved ones back home to try to convince themselves that they would soon return to them. Shackleton knew he had to keep the men busy because insanity would soon start to creep in.
Mm-hmm.
You have very little room on escape, so it's a very claustrophobic kind of feel. Yeah. 26 men stuck on a ship that's not moving at all. They would even put plays on. They started to put different plays on. The cook, or the chef, if you like, on board the ship, who they actually called Doughballs. That was the nickname they gave him. He baked up to a dozen loaves of bread a day for the men.
Holy shit.
And found new ways of preparing penguin.
Yeah?
Yeah, day after
some of
day.
The most famous penguin dishes to this day.
Exactly. Now, there's not... One of the things scurvy could have set in very quickly. There's not a whole pile of vitamin C in the meat from seals and penguins, but there would have been enough to stop these men from getting scurvy to the point where it would kill them.
Okay.
Just in case anybody was thinking, like, famous shipwrecks, you're going to get scurvy, pirates get scurvy.
I don't even really know what scurvy is.
Scurvy is basically lack of vitamin C, and you'll die from it.
It just kills you.
It kills you, yeah. And then they had 69 dogs on board, and those dogs needed walk, they needed fed, they needed, you know, everything. So they grew very, very close to the dogs. They would still lease them up because they're stuck in this huge floating field of ice. They lease them up the way they're supposed to, take them out for big long runs. Everything that the dogs needed to kind of stimulate them and do, they were their pets basically. They were more than just working dogs. They even gave some of them names like Samson, Nelson, and Smiler. They provided in this cold and barren place a place to express love and affections. But as the months passed, it became more and more difficult to keep spirits up. There is no desolation more complete than a polar night. 24 hours of darkness.
Oh, yeah.
Life without the sun is soul-destroying, and it made the incarceration nearly unbearable for some men. Sometimes cheering up the crew required drastic actions. And one man was known to take an ice bath at 29 degrees below freezing. But it provided a pleasant distraction. So basically, he stripped down, got in the ice bath, and everyone was kind of watching. Jesus, look at this idiot!
Idiot!
I
mean, it would definitely distract you.
Yeah.
How do you not die from that? Like, I mean, obviously they have enough provisions on board, but like, yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem wise to tempt fate in the Arctic by jumping into an ice bath.
No, I know. So the currents that were underneath them in the Weddell Sea was forcing the ice pack that they were sitting on north, carrying the Endurance with it. And the Weddell Sea is on a current that rotates clockwise as well. Okay. So they're going north and they're going clockwise. And measuring... So basically the current is called a gyre, and that's what the Captain Frank Worsley would have used to measure where they were at the time. Now, this is all he had to... Because these guys had no idea. He had a sextant, which is a device used
loving all these nautical terms.
It looks like a sextant, looks like, you know, the compasses that we use to draw circles in mathematics.
Yeah.
Looks like that, and you hold it up to your eye, but you have to use it, requires the sun. You have to look through the sun at one point, and then you measure where the sun is to the horizon, note the time, and you're supposed to do that a couple of times a day, and you find your bearing somehow like that. Being that they're in polar darkness, they couldn't use that, so he was trying to keep track of where they were based on the ocean currents. I don't even know how you begin to do that.
Like,
but the ice flows were so large, and they're still moving in all the time from this gyre, that the ice starts building up on top of the ship. Okay, and this started to prove quite costly, because pressure just builds and builds and builds, and this is an old wooden ship, D. And the men spent months hacking away at the ice, trying to keep the ship clear. And it was described as like a madness to have this optimism because all there, it's, you know, yeah, it's not going to work. Like, yeah. It's going to be bad.
Things are just getting worse and
the
worse.
The ship was literally being strangled. And eventually the wood started to split on the ship. And Frank Worsley had to admit that his ship was mortally wounded, basically. Endurance was mortally wounded.
Yeah, they're not going to be sailing out of this, basically.
No, basically no. But he was well aware of the fact as well that if they lost the ship, they would more than likely all perish. The ship was their home, their haven, their way out of this. You know, it was, I'd say, warmer in a ship than you would be sitting on top of fucking obviously, ice. Yeah. But on October 27th, 1915, almost a year to the day that they set off from Buenos Aires, they abandoned the ship.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost a year in that ship.
They decided enough was enough and they abandoned ship. And they were suddenly cast out upon the ice where they soon set up a camp, like a makeshift camp, basically. They took all their provisions off the boat. The boat was literally just wood.
They
took everything they cut off. And the men thought this was it. Like, it was only a matter of time now before they're going to perish in the cold. The obstacles in front of them seemed insurmountable. The icy depths below seemed to beckon. You've got 28 men now lying on a thin crust of ice, laying on top of an ocean. Yeah. And at any time, basically, these huge big ice blocks are pushing together. And when they do that, what happens is they come up, they kind of meet in the middle, and they rise, and then they break, basically. Yeah. So you could literally be lying there 1 minute and the ground below you break, and you're just going to drop into that water.
Isn't it crazy how whenever they were in the boat and the ice was surrounding them, it was thick and it was, you know, insurmountable and such a problem. And then once you're out on it, it's suddenly very, very thin.
It's very thin. Suddenly, like, that 2 foot of ice is like, oh dear, this is only 2 foot of ice.
A lot deeper. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's crazy. And they're just sitting, because they have obviously nowhere else.
They got nowhere else to go.
And so they're basically like, they're not only are they stuck in this like field of ice, but this field of ice is also moving
all the time.
So there could be much further from land than
originally expected. The ice is constantly moving north.
Yeah, away
also
from
constantly moving clockwise, and it's also constantly being destroyed by other ice being pushed in on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
The weight of that causing it to crush, and then it's like, what do you call it, like the tectonic plates when they meet and they push up. It's basically that. So these men, you imagine Dee going to bed at night and lying in your tent or whatever they have and thinking, at any minute this ground under me could give way and I could just,
you're just in the water then.
To that dark, horrible, deep, like the Weddell Sea is one of the deeper seas in the world. Like, it's, and it's pitch black,
freezing,
and
it's freezing, freezing cold.
Like, yeah. Frank Worsley was now a captain in a frozen ocean without a ship.
Yeah.
He writes that his crew, castaways, only had a faint hope of survival, but we could not succumb to despair. We had to determine a way forward. Frank Worsley felt that he should wait for the flow. To move towards open water and then set off in light boats. So he was happy to kind of bed in, wait for this ice to get closer towards the actual edge of the ice to where the ocean was, and then set off in the light boats. Shackleton, however, was something much different entirely, of course. And like anything, what Shackleton says goes. He wanted to march to Paulet Island, which were about 350 miles away.
What's he marching on?
Basically on ice. And 12 years earlier, there was a Swedish expedition that had built a hut there to survive, and he knew that that hut existed, and that's where he wanted to get to. Pardon me. So that's basically the plan that they set into motion. They were like, we're gonna take these boats.
Oh yeah.
There's three long lifeboats. We're gonna load everything into them, and we're gonna haul ass for 350 miles across this frozen expanse to this hut. And when we get there, at least we have a hut.
And that hut, is that on Antarctica?
Antarctica.
Okay.
Yeah.
God.
So they were forced to get rid of literally everything that wasn't, that would weigh them down, basically. Yeah. And this is where the first of the kind of big drastic decisions had to be made, because there was the carpenter of the ship called McNeice. He actually had a pet cat.
Oh no.
Mm-hmm. And the pet cat was seen as, it's another mouth to feed. We don't need it. It shouldn't have been on board.
Jesus.
And ultimately they were forced to kill the cat.
Poor cat.
Kind of put it out of its misery, if you like. Well, instead of leaving it on a frozen, where it would,
it's just going to die.
And he kind of, there was a lot of resentment then from this Carpenter McNeice towards Shackleton, you know. He never forgave Shackleton for issuing the order to kill his cat. However, the dogs were still very much a valuable part.
Well, that's because you need those to traverse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the men started dragging these huge fucking lifeboats weighing nearly a ton.
Oh, because they have to drag them over the ice.
They got to drag them over the ice.
Fuck, because I was wondering when you said that. I was like, okay, so can they move through this ice because the boats are a bit smaller? But no, they have to drag them over the ice.
They're dragging over the top of the ice, like literally hauling with ropes set across like their heads and across their shoulders, and just they're trying to drag. And it became very obvious within a few days of this that they were achieving nothing other than trashing the bottom sides of the boats and completely destroying the men, basically. Yeah, you know, these are men who are already starting to ration their food and their intake, you know. Shackleton eventually had to admit to himself, yes, it is a crazy idea.
Yeah.
And we basically just have to stay put, and we have to wait, and we have to see where these currents are going to take us. And they established a camp called Ocean Camp. Okay,
that's not very reassuring.
No. So a couple of days they tried to walk, realized they were getting nowhere, and they established Ocean Camp, a home made miserable by the summer thaw. The surface of the floe was a quagmire of melted snow and rotting ice, and all of their belongings suddenly became constantly sodden, so constantly wet and damp. They were still in view of Endurance, so even though they walked for 3 days,
they could still see
the boat. Like, I think in the 3 days they only covered something like, I think one of the documentaries I've seen said they covered something like, I want to say, it's less than a mile.
Yeah,
you know, less than a mile. It's super low, like a backbreaking work, and they can still see the Endurance. She's starting to capsize now. She's starting to go on her side, and the ice is just swallowing her up. And over the next 2 months of being in this ocean camp, they slowly watched the Endurance be crushed by the ice, before she was eventually swallowed, just taken down. Yeah. And actually, Frank Hurley actually managed to get the footage of the ship going down. It's super. You can check it out. I'll probably link it in the description of this podcast, just so you can see it. But it's so eerie, like, because there's nothing. And it's just this big wooden ship, and it's just been pulled under, like as if it's been pulled under by some kind of sea monster or something, you know. But that was very, very difficult for Frank Worsley, because that was his ship essentially. Uh-huh. He had to watch it being eaten by the snow. So they moved. 5 weeks later, they said they were in Ocean Camp for 5 weeks, and they began a second attempt then to cross the ice. So we're kind of going back and forth with, no, we're going to stay put, we're going to wait for the currents, and then everybody gets fed up, and it's like, you know, onwards, we're going to keep moving, we can do this, we've regained a little bit of strength, let's keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And they trekked at night this time, when the ice was crispier, so it was
cooler.
Okay. But once again, it was a slow, soul-destroying journey, and this was the first time that some of the crew members started to query and question Ernest's command of the men. There was about 300 miles to go. So they only moved like, 50 miles.
So they're still going to this...
Still going to this hut. Okay. Still trying to get to this hut. The lifeboats that were going to see of them, ultimately when they got there, couldn't be damaged. And they were being damaged with all this hauling across. And this McNish, the guy who had to kill the cat, the carpenter, he was very vocal in his distrust of Shackleton. And he kind of, not I wouldn't call it revolt or anything, but I think he got inside some of the other men's heads.
What is
this man doing? You know, we need those boats. This is suicide, you know. And basically staged a mutiny, you know, and just said, this is crazy. We can't be doing this. We've got no food. Shackleton, at this point, brought out his revolver and threatened to shoot McNeish if he didn't do what he was told. So things are starting to heat up a lot, like, you know. And one of the things about this was that the men, during that whole time, that whole first year, were able to keep such high spirits and able to keep themselves, you know, cheery and kind of optimistic. And now suddenly it's starting to fall apart a little bit, you know.
I mean, I'm impressed that they made this for a year. Like, a month or two of living that close quarters with very little hope would probably do it to most people, but obviously he picked a good bunch.
Yeah.
But falling apart now. That's a big move, whipping out the revolver, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's like a boss move right there. Like, you know, and especially whenever it's someone who Shackleton was described as never really being invested in the men the same way Frank Worsley was. He's kind of just like this head guy who's now just kind of walked in. You can kind of picture the type, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he just pointed the gun and was like, you're doing what I say.
Exactly.
And
you're going to do this. Yeah.
And you can kind of almost picture Frank Worsley kind of being like squirming, being like, oh, don't do this, man. You know, like, this is not the way to go. So this is what's happening. And they march on, and for 7 more days, they marched on. And eventually, they did the math, and they had only covered, after 7 grueling days, 10 miles.
God.
So Frank Worsley sat down with the boss and explained that at the rate of the journey, it would take them over a year to hit this cut, at which point everybody would have perished. So
fucking hell.
Yeah. So it was again decided that we would stop.
Ocean Camp 2.0.
Exactly. Frank explained that the best chance was to wait for the ice, the moving ice, carried to water, and we established a new home and a new camp. Indeed, they call this camp Patience Camp. Ironically named.
Yeah.
It was almost a year since Endurance had become trapped, and these men could no longer remember life on land at all.
Yeah.
And they set up this camp with mounting desperation, a camp called Endurance Camp. Everything was starting to be drained entirely. Their main sources of sustenance, penguins and seals, started to disappear because suddenly there's a hunter in the mix. So they started pushing further and further away. Rations were reduced to a mere 9.5 ounces a day. I don't really know what ounces
and
are.
Neither do I.
But I assume it's, from the documentaries I watched, it's about a ladleful.
Oh.
A little more than a ladleful.
Okay, yeah.
I think.
That is grim.
These don't say ounces, do they?
No, these are milliliters. We don't use freedom units.
Yeah, so it's pretty grim. It's super grim. Hunger was a constant companion, and the men became obsessed with food. Facing starvation, they could no longer spare meat for the dogs.
Oh,
so
no.
They were already feeding. Like, there's 69 dogs.
Yeah,
like, that's
a
lot of mouths.
Whenever you were saying that, when they were still on the boat, I was like, they're feeding themselves and all those dogs. Like, an army of dogs.
Yeah.
That's wild that they were able to do it for as long as they did.
Well, this is where it does take another distressing turn. They were left with no choice but to shoot the dogs and eat the meat.
I was gonna say I was expecting that to happen whenever you mentioned, because I forgot about the dogs until you mentioned that they were feeding the dogs, and I was like, oh god, the dogs.
Now that is
the poor dogs.
That's a decision that was a very distressing decision that had to be made. It was the men all had wrote. Sorry, I meant to say that before one of the what do you call it, the prerequisites, if you like, or I forget the word, but if you were coming on board this ship and you kept a diary, you kept a log, all those logs were property of Ernest Shackleton.
Oh, okay.
So whatever you wrote, he was going to take at the end.
So this was his story, this was his expedition.
Exactly,
right?
His stories. But Shackleton, that's why it's always known as Shackleton's expedition, you know?
Yeah.
All this stuff, everything the man
He was obviously very savvy in that way. Obviously, exploring a lot of great things, but that's why he was
in
charge.
He's a businessman.
Yeah, that's why he was in charge, because he was doing these. He was bringing the photographer, he was getting the PR, he was raising the money, he was creating the story. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's wild.
But so a lot of the men had wrote that this was the most distressing thing that they had done so far,
because these were pets. They'd named them and they had like grown attached in a greater way than you would if it was just like a work animal, you know.
But eventually
they kill all the dogs.
They killed all the dogs.
Oh man.
Yeah, 69 dogs all shot. I suppose we can't say it, because we're not in that situation, but a life and death situation.
Oh, I get it. Like,
yeah, you kind of get it, you know.
It would obviously break your heart, but it's literally like
it's me or the dog. Yeah. I feel sorry for the cook, Doughballs, who had to start cooking dogs.
Oh Jesus
and
Christ.
Especially because I don't imagine they would have shot all 69 at once. So the
no.
poor dogs who were kind of watching
God.
The other dogs being slain. I'm sorry, I'm painting such a horrible picture of this,
but
it is. It's the grim reality,
was,
you know.
Yeah. God, poor dogs.
But eventually the day came when the ice broke up and water was eventually sighted. So maybe all these things were kind of coming together for them. Look, here we go, we've got water. And they launched their lifeboats and they set off in search of land. Now, this was 15 months after being on water to begin with. And a lot of the men had lost their sea legs So seasickness was a big part of this. Men were not used to being back on currents, back in the water.
And they're only in wee dinghy lifeboats now as well.
Exactly. And they were being... they had a new threat now, which was being crushed by these huge, big moving icebergs. Now, we're talking icebergs that are maybe miles in size.
Yeah.
That were, you know the way the sides of icebergs kind of fall off?
Uh-huh.
And icebergs move pretty quickly as well. Like, so they were also on constant... look out for icebergs, and of course then the natural, like the waves, the ocean, whatever, just the ocean in general, like, you know, could have sank them. So they split up between all three boats, and there was actually, there's a couple of pictures that you can check out, because there's an expedition artist that was brought along, called George Mardson, and he captured the vulnerability of the situation in a couple of the drawings that he'd done aboard one of these boats, and you can see in some of the waves and things that they're up against. They head for the South Shetland Islands, 50 miles away, because they weren't yet in open sea, they had all the risk of the ice. In terms of the small boats, Worsley obviously had the most experience being a captain. He knew how to navigate, so he kind of led the pack, but he knew that it was too dangerous to travel at night, so they camped on icebergs at night. They would sail during the day.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
So they would like come ashore on an iceberg.
On an iceberg, basically. God. Too dangerous to sail at night. And
that is a big, because I was going to say, at night you just don't see anything.
Yeah.
Like there's icebergs and you just won't be able to see them. So that's a big.
Yeah. I say that they camped on bergs, but it was noted that sleep was almost impossible at this point. The men were completely weak without sleep and without food and adequate food or adequate warmth. Some of them were incredibly seasick, and the weight of responsibility on the men was almost too much. Frank Worsley was trying to navigate using a sextant through glimpses of the sun. Now I'm talking glimpses, we're talking maybe 10 seconds twice a day, twice in 24 hours, the sun would come out, and he had to be ready for it, to catch the sun, bring it down to the horizon, mark where they are, and then use that to seal to try navigate. To find their land, which is crazy. But after 3 days of rowing, his calculations indicated that the currents had actually pushed them back 30 miles towards their starting point.
Oh my god.
So it's like just, one step forward and 30 miles back. Do you know what I mean?
You're like literally rowing like upstream.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. These men are also rowing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, these are men who are actually back rowing these boats. Yeah. But he kept this information from the crew.
Well, yeah.
He didn't tell.
For morale. You know?
So they actually headed to the uninhabited Elephant Island, it's called. It's like a little tiny dot, like a grain of sand basically on a beach in this vast fucking southern ocean. And some of the men began to lose their sanity a little bit. Killer whales started to cruise beneath the boats like black torpedoes, threatening to kite them at any time.
God.
And they were actually followed at one point, I think, on one of the diary entries, they were followed by a pod of whales at one point, who the men believed were basically like vultures, basically like water vultures. They were waiting for these men to. I don't know if whales would react.
I was
going to
say, I don't know if whales eat like
exactly
men, people,
but there you go.
Not stopping them.
And every day the temperature dropping, because we're now starting to get off the summer and move into winter. Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Holy hell!
After 5 days on the water. The men were freezing to death. Fresh water was now in a seriously short supply, and they resorted to chewing on raw seal meat and fat just for the sake of the blood. It's a state that you get to when things are completely grim, writes Worsley. Life just doesn't seem that important. And Captain Worsley was now on the helm of this boat, so he was leading the way for 40 hours non-stop at this point where I'm starting to write. The thing about being on the helm of one of these boats, especially with the weather conditions, D, was you were constantly, if you picture sitting upright and now bent over from the wind, like, I'll demonstrate it.
Question, are you sitting and bending right now?
It's kind of hard to explain unless you see it, but it was wrote that several men actually had to bend Frank back into position.
Yeah.
Because the cold had froze him
in place.
In place.
Like rigor mortis.
Pretty much. That's exactly it. In a very acute angle, and he had to be bent back into. But this was the kind of leader that Frank Worsley was. And then, just when all hope was lost and they were doomed, Elephant Island appeared.
Okay, I was waiting for something, another bad thing to happen.
Oh, don't worry, don't worry. you had to speak. Elephant Island appeared, but they weren't able to make landfall that night.
Oh, no.
A giant gale out of nowhere blew in, and they lost sight of the land.
That's just not what you need.
That's
just not what you need for morale.
The men and Frank Worsley are certain that if they hadn't have seen Elephant Island before the gale blew in, that storm that blew in would have defeated them and they all would have perished.
Yeah.
But their hopes were kept, and they saw a glimpse. They knew there's an island there. Like, yeah. We can do this. We can get to this island. And after 15 months on the ice and 7 grueling days at sea, all 28 men made landfall on April 15th, 1916, without losing anybody. A true miracle. So they reach Elephant Island. Now, this is a desolate, uninhabited piece of rock, but it's better than being on ice. Yeah, exactly. We're solid. We're not going to move here. Yeah.
It's not going to break beneath our feet at any moment. It's not going to veer us 1,000 miles off course. It's just...
Yeah, they made camp on a beach, and it was beach camp, basically. These
camps, like, the names are getting less inspiring.
But most of the island was guarded by 100-foot-high ice cliffs with glaciers and crevasses, and it was an unbelievably violent place, one of the most inhospitable places on Earth that these men could have landed. Now, it's called Elephant Island for the elephant seals.
Oh, okay. That's
right. There you go, just a tidbit for you, just in case anyone's like, why Elephant Island?
Yeah, I was wondering myself.
This big fucking African elephant rolling around, you know?
How'd they get there?
But the thing is, they had only themselves to look at, because nobody was interested back home in searching for missing explorers.
Yeah.
At this time, there was a war effort on back home. Mm-hmm. And Winston Churchill actually is on record snaring at them, calling the men penguins, saying that these men shouldn't have been there because there's a war effort. Fighting. They should have been out in France or wherever the war was taking. It is France, isn't it? The Somme, all that. So nobody cared that these men were missing, basically. So it was on themselves. They either had to get home themselves or that was it. No one was coming looking for them. So now they had to put a new plan, basically. And the closest settlement to where they were was Port Stanley on the Falkland Islands, but that was Shackleton who mentioned that. But Worsley determined that the winds favoured an attempt at South Georgia, back to, remember, where the whaling station was,
where the Norwegians are.
The whaling station is 800 miles away.
Oh no.
Yeah,
well, I mean, everything's pretty far, right?
It's super far. Like, I couldn't believe, like, I was always I don't know why, but I kept thinking,
Once you hit land,
like, the next bit of land is probably just
Land is land. So once you've hit it, you're basically
800 miles. Yeah, the size of this earth is crazy. Like,
The fact that you can go 1,000 miles south from Argentina, the south of Argentina, that astounded me. Like, I didn't think there was that much of a gap between it and the South Pole, but yeah, there it is.
And not hit land until you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's big.
But they would attempt to reach the whaling station they visited what seemed like a lifetime before. And in a dramatic scene, which Frank Worsley recalls in his journals, a scene that he shall never forget, the boss addressed the men. He outlined the plan to them and made it clear that this journey promised to be even more difficult than anything that they had experienced to date. He was also honest about the slim chance of success. Despite the great risk of failure, every single man volunteered for this expedition, this trek from one part of Elephant Island, the 800 miles,
To the whaling station. Holy shit. On lifeboats. Which had been destroyed by being dragged over ice.
Yeah. But obviously, they weren't taking every single man. 4 were chosen to join Shackleton and Worsley. They weren't going to risk it. So basically, these men had stopped and they were using their lifeboats as cover, and they were using it as shelter.
Yeah.
And now what Shackleton was basically saying is, 800 miles away is the station. If we all go, there's a good chance that we're gonna die.
Uh-huh.
So they're looking for a crew, basically take the biggest boat, and they're gonna try to set sail, hit this land, and then come back, and we'll pick you all up. So you just hang on, you just hang tight.
Jesus. That's a lot of trust.
And he was very open and honest about the small chance of success. Now imagine what these men that were feeling, who were kind of left. It's not even a wonder that everybody volunteered, because if you're left behind and you're thinking those guys have no chance, you're basically just going to wait there until
you're going to live perish. Off of seal meat and like
eventually do you turn to cannibalism?
Well,
do you
know what I mean? Don't know. Yeah.
So four men joined Shackleton. McNish, the guy who lost the carpenter. Yeah. John Vincent and two Irishmen, actually, called Tim McCarthy and Tom Crane. Now, Shackleton was said to have been a great persuader. He had this amazing ability to gather people around him and kind of get into their heads and inspire them and lead them, even if they were going right into the jaws of darkness. Mm-hmm. You know, these men were willing to follow him. They threw themselves onto a lifeboat that they called the James Caird or Keared. It was 22 feet 6 inches long, and it was the largest of the three lifeboats. And first and foremost was the importance of covering the lifeboat by McNish the carpenter. So basically they took wood and stuff off the other lifeboats and covered the whole top of it, so they had somewhere to get in under out of the elements. And they put a huge a ballast. On one side of the inside of the boat, they put all these huge big rocks from Elephant Island to make a strong ballast that would stop the boat from moving too much in the currents and things.
Yeah.
Keep it a wee bit steadier. They cannibalized the two smaller boats. And this was such a sacrifice because it meant that the men left behind
had no shelter.
They also had no shelter, and if these men didn't come back,
they have no boats.
They got no boats. Yeah. So it's a do or die kind of mission here. Shackleton wanted a very heavy ballast. Worsley didn't, but Shackleton won out in the end. Surprise, surprise. And then this is the last that Frank Hurley seen of these men, the photographer seen of these men, and you can actually watch the video, which is crazy.
As they seal off.
The actual thing of these six men sailing off in a boat and leaving the other 24 men stranded in this island, and there's the pictures. That night before they left, they had a big sing song and they sat around and camaraderie was high, and you know, even though in the back of their heads they were kind of thinking this is probably the last we're going to see each other, and they drank some kind of weird like alcohol that they had, and you know, that was it, you know,
made out of fucking seal fat.
But Worsley even writes that he knew that this would probably be the last time that he would ever see most of these men. They were waiting for these men to sail across 800 miles of the world's worst ocean in winter. Mm-hmm. But first they had a lot of ice to work their way through and a lot of overcast weather, which meant difficulty in getting sights on the Saxon and knowing exactly where they are. And after 800 miles, you have a target of this whaling station island, South Georgia, which is only 100 miles long, which in the grand scheme of things in an ocean is a very, very small dot to aim at, especially when you're coming in from God knows where in whatever weather, you know. But by darkness, on the first night, they cleared the ice surrounding Elephant Island and they reached open water. And below deck, any hopes that were made of sheltering from the wet and freezing conditions were gone. The cramped space meant that the men had to lie on the ballast rocks. And the night's conditions confirmed that this was going to be a really, really tough journey. Shackleton confessed to Worsley at that point that he didn't know anything about sailing or small boats.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What are you doing here?
I know, right?
We're leading an expedition. I don't know how to seal.
I've never been in this situation before, and I'm counting on you, were the words that he told Worsley. He knew nothing about sailing and was totally in the hands of Frank Worsley. So it was up to Frank Worsley to get these men to that 100-mile landing zone. It was 3 days of sailing before he even glimpsed the sun.
Jesus.
And when he did, he managed to shout the sight to Sir Ernest below. He'd yell, "Mark." And Shackleton would mark the time that he shouts. And basically, it's for like longitude. Sightings.
Longitude and longitude.
Yeah, sightings, basically. I don't even know how you go about navigating like that. That's crazy.
You need to know the exact time and you need to know the exact location of the sun and then you can work out where you are. It's wild.
So you think, like, you imagine trying to sit on these freezing cold, like, you don't know how tough it is to do anything when your hands are cold and you're cold, but to sit on these on a boat that's constantly rocking back and forth in the middle of an ocean at night with water swelling around the place, to shout, to do these fine calculations to work out where you are. Worsley had only 4 sightings of the sun in 16 days.
Jesus.
Yeah, so one sighting every 4 days. How the hell are you supposed to work out where the hell you are?
Yeah.
One side of the sun for
that's impossible.
We're talking like the when I think about it, I'm constantly thinking of a man looking at the sun all the time and being like, yeah, okay, yeah, well, here
I'm
we
making
are.
Fine adjustments. Exactly. Like, oh, we're a little bit off course, let's adjust.
Exactly.
He has one every 4 days, or yeah, every 4 days. That's insane. Obviously, he has experience, like vast experience,
super experience
to be able to get remotely in the right direction from that. That is crazy.
Yeah.
Driving blind, basically.
He felt basically. He knew which way the currents were going based on what the way they were being pulled. He felt what the speed of the boat was. And this is where he came up with some kind of map in his brain, basically, that he could say at the end of the day he'd made 56 miles in a northeasterly direction, or whatever northeast should be at that point. To do all of that in his head is like it's a gift, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's just, you can't, you just have to... Yeah, years of experience to get there.
Ice started to build up though on the boat, on the hull, and it threatened to sink them. They didn't have any sailing clothes, they didn't have any sailing boots, they didn't have waterproof gloves. They're on this boat that's been thrown about 20 feet in the air at a time. Could have very easily lost a man overboard at any time. The freezing conditions were so bitter that one man could only bear to work on the deck for 5 minutes at a time,
and they have to go back under
Jeez. And try to keep warm whatever way they could.
It's insane that they did lasted so long on the lifeboats without the cover and
yeah,
stuff.
Like, unbelievable. Like, yeah.
Probably just hold together.
Different part of the sea, I suppose. Like, they were sailing through, like, ice, which would have been calm, you know.
Oh,
just
yeah, yeah, I suppose.
Ice, you know? It wouldn't have been cold, but you wouldn't have been getting wet and saturated. And they were getting no rest, and whatever rest they were getting was lying on these huge ballast rocks. The only good part of the day was when the men were served hot hoosh. it was a life-saving mixture which consisted of hot milk mixed with something called pemmican, which is a high fat compressed meat, and it combats hypothermia due to the fat content in it. It basically looks like I looked it up, it looks like a block of tofu.
Okay.
Basically, and it's a high fat content, it mixed with hot milk, and then it basically it'll stop you from getting hypothermia.
Just sustenance.
Yeah. And then you imagine trying to cook that in underneath.
Yeah, what are they cooking it on? Like gas stove?
A little stove.
Holy
yeah.
shit.
But they suffered extreme stomach pains and cramps, and the misery started to overwhelm the men once again. And by the second week, Frank had grave concerns for his crew, as his hands and knees were now starting to become raw from crawling over the ballast rocks. Limbs were sore, and the men were covered with sores. But the worst thing that he notes was the sleeping bags that they did have were starting to rot, because the sleeping bags were made with reindeer skin and fur, and the salt water on the hairs started to disintegrate the bags, and hair and matted fur was just over everything.
Gross.
And it's cold and it's wet, and it was just a salty mess, basically. McNish, the carpenter, was now at this point severely frostbitten. I think his face, maybe, and lost the will to live. They were hit by rogue waves all the time that could have finished them in seconds, and there was nothing that nature didn't throw at them. However, by the 13th day, despite having only managed 3 sun sights with the sextant, Frank was confident that they were nearing their destination. And by his reckoning, South Georgia was only a mere 15 miles away.
Oh,
I began watching for the telltale signs of land, he wrote. And then on the 7th of May, young Tim McCarthy, whose optimism had never wavered, spotted the peaks of South Georgia.
Oh my God.
However.
Oh no.
As you know this story. Exactly. As you know the nature of this journey, they were to be tested yet again, Dee. And as making landfall was to be extremely difficult. The weather turned and they were hit by another severe gale. And in that same storm, there was a hurricane force blow. So basically, this is crazy. They were hit by the storm that came in, and this storm elsewhere on the water, somewhere else away from them, actually sank a 500 ton steamer on her way to South Georgia with coal for the whaling station.
Crazy.
But these men were in this little tiny lifeboat, you know what I mean?
That's wild.
That 500 ton steamer disappeared without a trace and every soul on board.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
And these guys are just like holding off for dear life.
Yeah.
So
basically he had to do as far as I know, I'm not too confident in my seafaring terms, but only Frank Worsley knew how to beat off a lee shore, which is one of the most terrifying things a seaman can ever encounter. It's basically they were coming in, and it was too dangerous to land, so they'd come in nice and close to land, but then they'd have to sail back out, and then they'd try it again and sail back out and try it again. And I think this is what they had to do until they found like the right spot or whatever. But they were doing it, they were constantly being pulled away from the island.
Oh, I see.
So if they were swept straight past South Georgia,
they'd just be swept away.
Like, yeah, basically, yeah.
Not
yeah.
getting back yeah. to land.
They had to make landfall as quickly as possible, and they landed at a place that they called Cape Cove. And Frank's 20 plus years under sail and operating small boats around New Zealand was crucial to this deal. It was a masterpiece of navigation, no question whatsoever. And the men finally had their feet on real land. Not Elephant Island's rocky, icy shingle beach, but this was land that now had grass and heather and fresh, clear water. So the men were able to kind of sit here. They caught elephant seals and albatrosses, big birds. They cooked those. They got fresh water. They started to regain their strength. But however, they knew, they spent a couple of days building up their strength, but because they knew that there was 22 other men still waiting on them, they knew they had to get going. Uh-huh. The storm that blew them on to South Georgia, unfortunately, blew them on to the wrong side of South Georgia Island.
Of course it did.
Yeah. The whaling station was literally at the exact opposite side.
100 miles away. Or something like that.
Very close to, yeah. If they wanted to sail around the island from one bit around the top and round, it would be 150 miles.
They're not sailing though, are they? They're not getting back in that boat, are they?
The late storm had severely damaged the James Caird, which was a lifeboat, and Vincent McNish were near death, so going back to sea was not an option. Ernest Shackleton and Frank Worsley agreed that walking across the island's uncharted interior was their only chance. And the condition of the men was such that it would be impossible for all the men to make the journey. So Sir Ernest Shackleton, Frank Worsley, and Tom Crean, which was one of the guys that came along with them, would attempt to make the crossing, which would leave young McCarthy, the other guy McCarthy, to care for the other two men here. So now if these men got across, they would now have to come back for these men and then go back for the other 22 waiting. This as well, South Georgia Island, that whaling station is the only thing that's on it. It's never been charted. Nobody walks across it. You know the story. You know at this
You know the gist at this point, yeah.
No one had been into the interior of the island, so they needed clear weather, and then they waited for a full moon. And in the middle of that night, 9 days after making landfall, they set off. After previous ordeals were thin, wasted, and poorly equipped, the men set off with nothing but a 90-foot rope attached around them. They also have obviously like whatever supplies they would have needed, but the only useful piece of kit basically was a 90-foot rope that they took. They took brass screws from the lifeboat and screwed them into the soles of their shoes to make rudimentary crampons to give grip to the ice. But not being mountaineers, it was pretty damn frightening for them.
So it's not like planes, like they're climbing over mountains.
It's snow. It's like snow covered peaks, basically. Yeah, rocky snow covered peaks. Really barren, just open land. Again, just in the middle of fucking nowhere. Like,
yeah.
The men knew that they couldn't afford to take a tent with them, so they didn't. Just three men, literally. And they knew that if they got caught by a blizzard, they would more than likely die. Like, it's game over. So they just had to just keep moving. Just. Doesn't matter what. And once again, Frank Worsley was put in charge of being the navigator. No one had crossed the island before, and we knew the mountains to be at least 9,000 feet high, he wrote. He estimated they were 25 to 30 miles away from the whaling station, although he had no way of being certain. He tried to illustrate the journey in some of his journals, but he said he hoped not to be too confused by the exhaustion he felt at the time. We didn't know where we were going or what obstacles lay ahead. Too often we had to double back. Retracing our steps was a devastating blow and tested our resolve to carry on. The going was so demanding, we had to halt every 20 minutes.
Fuck.
Now you can. There's a map that I checked out of the journey, and it is the move. Like a mile this way, and then they got to come 3/4 of a mile back because it's impassible. Another mile this way, 3/4 of a mile back. It's just constantly against them.
You're only ever moving 20 minutes and you're stopping. And 20 minutes, you're stopping. Would just break you down.
These brief rest stops, the men could not allow themselves to sleep, as to sleep would be to die. If they fell asleep, the hypothermia would kick in. You're not going to wake up. We were so tired that at one point, Shackleton told us he would give us a half an hour sleep, wrote Worsley. Shackleton, though, only gave them 5 minutes and woke them up, saying that they had been asleep for a half an hour because he was scared that the men would not wake up at all. So they kept going. And normally what happens when you're traversing with a glacier rope is you're all tied together.
Yeah.
And when one man falls, he pulls the other two men down, or when one man slips. But the thing was, they somehow managed to keep up like these high spirits, and when one man fell, they kind of laughed at him and made jokes or whatever, and kept tally of who failed the most, and they just kept going. Now, these are men who have, you know what they've been through.
Been through already. Yeah. Like, they've been out for like new 2 years now. I wouldn't have the patience for that. Like, I'd just be completely wicked and gone. I'd be dead.
Throughout the journey, Worsley writes that throughout the journey, all three of us had a strong feeling of being accompanied by a fourth man, yet nobody spoke of it. So,
okay, fair.
And it is perhaps this soul who kept the men safe. 16 hours after they set off, they came to an edge of a precipice, but had no idea what lay below. Time was running out, however, and the men could not turn back. It was decided that they would use their rope as a sled and throw themselves into the void.
That's a beautiful way to put, like, throw ourselves into the void.
If the men were to die, it would be on their own terms. So basically, there's this huge, like, slope, and they just thought, we have to get down it. There's no other way. So they decide to sit on this 90-foot rope back to back to back and just throw themselves into it. And if they're going to die, they're dying on their own terms. The toboggan ride, that they call it, threw them 1,000 feet down the slope.
A thousand feet.
1,000 feet. And they cheated death again.
On a rope.
On a rope. Is
just a rope into a ball or something.
Yeah, pretty much. Just a rope into a ball. Knotted it a couple of times so it wouldn't give way. And they just sat on it and threw themselves. Yeah.
Jesus. Everything they've done so far was calculated, I think. Like, we have to do this, and we'll do this, and we'll keep going, and we'll have this option, we'll do this, blah, blah, blah. And, like, it was always, like, unlikely, but logistically possible that they would survive. This is the first time I've heard of them do something like, well, fuck it. YOLO.
That's it.
Let's hop on this rope.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Because they're like, we don't have the energy to do anything else.
Don't have the energy, but also, on top of that, there's no plan B. You think that you've left like 20 something of your friends behind, and their lives are based in your hands. And if you're going to titter and tatter and, oh, will we, won't we? It's just a matter of, fucker, let's just try it and see.
Well, that's it. But part of me was like, if their lives in your hands, like, would you want to take the risk? Would you
want to, exactly, yeah.
But obviously, this is the point where, like, there is no plan B. There is no other option. We do this or we don't make it. We die, they die. Yeah. Either way, so
after cheating death, the men were, of course, utterly driven. You know, a huge sense of yes, we can do this.
We made it.
Yet they still had another large range to cross. They ran out of kerosene halfway through their crossing, so they had their last hoosh. So this was it. They had no more food at this point. So whatever they had, they're going to have to make do with. And then Shackleton reportedly heard the sound of a whistle, although he wasn't sure. This was at 6:30 a.m. So the men stopped. Didn't know what was going on. Good. So they all waited, and they waited to 7 o'clock, another half hour, and they listened, and they were waiting to hear if they hear this whistle again. And sure enough, it was the first sound that all of them heard in 17 months. A large whistle went off to resume work, which meant the whaling station was very, very close.
Nearby.
It was a marvelous moment, and after 36 hours, half frozen and nearly unconscious, they crested a peak, and there was the whaling station. At the sight of men and buildings and of all those things they'd done so long without, it meant safety, and more than anything else, it meant possible rescue and safety for the other 22 men. The burden of carrying their lives with them is what kept Shackleton, Worsley and Crean going. For the first time after abandoning Endurance, which was the original ship way back, the men enjoyed a hot bath, a change of clothes, and a shave. That same night, then, they boarded a boat to go back out
to get the others.
We could not rest until everyone was safe. Tom Crean, Sir Ernest, and I were forced to abandon 3 separate attempts to reach Elephant Island because of just the weather and the conditions. Ice, basically. Yeah.
So they got the guys on the whaling station island, did they?
No, that is Elephant Island. Sorry, that is Elephant Island.
No, but the guys that they brought, the guys, the six of them went, and then only three of them got to the whaling station. So the other three that were...
Oh, yes.
They were just picked up, I guess.
Yes, of course. Yeah, sorry. I should have mentioned that. Yeah. They went back around and they picked up... hang on, let me get that right. How have I skipped that?
So they're not really... not as difficult to get to, I suppose.
Yeah, no... You know, they got them men. I don't know why I skipped that little piece. But yeah, sorry, they picked up the three men who were waiting on them around McNeice the carpenter, and the other two men who were with them. They picked them up, and then they had to abandon three separate attempts to reach the men who were back in Elephant Island. 22 men would have been waiting for them. The boats were either too small or unsafe to take into icy waters. Jesus. And they were desperately trying to get help out from Britain at this point. So they're writing back home.
Yeah.
Okay, this has been a disaster. We need help. Nobody wanted to offer any help at all. And the men knew that if this was the shape that they were in, then God knows what those men were like originally on Elephant Island. Then on the fourth attempt in a Chilean boat called the Yelko, we sighted the island finally. It had been 128 days since they left the shore.
128 days since they left Elephant Island?
Since they left the 22 men behind.
They've been there for 128 days.
Yeah.
128 days later?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It seemed too much to expect after 4 months of winter on a godforsaken lump of rock that any shipmates could be alive. The whole split could have swept everything clear during the winter storms, and they were sure that nobody was left alive at all. As they neared the coast, they watched through a pair of binoculars, and slowly men started to gather on the beach.
Holy shit.
Slowly the numbers started growing, and the boss Shackleton, who had the binoculars at the time, counted anxiously, and it took a bit of time, and then he spoke the words, "They're all there, skipper, they're all alive, and they're coming home."
Class.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
The men had not conquered Antarctica, but their greatest success was their survival.
Yeah.
Across this, Frank never lost hope, and somebody once said he was not born to be drowned. He did not believe that he could go get through everything, and did. Getting everybody home was Shackleton's responsibility as a leader, but without Frank Worsley, there was no way he would have managed it, and all the credit went to Shackleton.
Oh, naturally, yeah.
That's just the sort of man that he was. But without question, the journey could not have been achieved without Frank Worsley's contribution and expertise in sea navigation.
Well, that's it. I mean, they are obviously every single man on that, and dog, for that matter. Were, you know, all responsible for them making it
exactly
how they did. That's incredible. And I mean, yeah, credit to Shackleton for, like, actually, because, like, what I was expecting is him to land on this island and be like, right, I'm off,
yeah,
I'm heading back to England,
I'm done, like, yeah,
hope you, good luck with getting them boys back. But no, he did go and get them, and he obviously had an investment in getting them all back.
He did, he got them back. Now what happened afterwards, I looked into it a little bit, if I can remember. Most of the men actually got home and went straight into the war effort.
Oh.
Just went straight back out.
Probably a lot of them lost their lives there.
Yeah, a lot of them were dead within 7 to 10
That's crazy.
Months. Shackleton went back for another Arctic expedition, joined by Frank Worsley. And they made it to South Georgia Island again, the whaling station, and he actually succumbed to an illness and died. Shackleton died that island. That's where he's buried, actually, South Georgia Island. Frank then returned to Britain and went on giving lectures and talks about this expedition in particular. Frank Hurley, who was the photographer, went on to document the war efforts, and he became known as a war journalist, I guess, at that point. Who else was there? McNeice. Oh, this was ludicrous. So that guy McNeice, the carpenter.
Yeah.
All the men received a medal. It's called the... It's not called the South Pole Medal. It was basically a medal of heroism for survival against the odds or whatever.
Yeah.
And Shackleton refused to award McNeice his medal because he started the mutiny against him back. Fuck. And so he died without receiving his medal, basically.
So he didn't want it anyway.
No. That's shitty though. Like,
that is,
you know?
Shitty, yeah. Especially because he's the one who brought him with him on that little
boat, yeah.
And like, they obviously spent all that time together, and they never got over it.
No,
that's a petty thing to do.
Isn't it, like, the type of man Shackleton was? Like, he never forgot, like, he never forgave either, really, from the sounds of things.
pretty petty, but
it is pretty petty. Yeah, there was one man actually just died an alcoholic. I forget who he was. Like, I think it maybe was too much for him when he turned to alcohol, yeah. And that was it. Died an alcoholic so many years later. It's an incredible story. Everybody knows it as Shackleton's expedition, but through everything I've read and the documentaries I've watched, like, without Frank Worsley, those men would have been dead in the first, like, when the ice closed in around them. And the reason I brought this one up, Dee, is because I don't know if you've seen in the news, but probably 2 weeks ago now, they actually sent a submersible down, and they finally, after all this time, found the Endurance at the bottom of the Weddell Sea.
Class.
Perfectly preserved in the cold.
That's insane.
And they don't want to, they say they can't lift it up. They'll never lift it up because it'll destroy. But there's amazing pictures on the internet at the minute, and over the last couple of weeks in the news, it's been there, of this huge wooden ship just lying at the bottom of these cold, dark, icy waters, like, and it's perfectly preserved. The Endurance along the back,
that's insane.
It's incredible. Like, that's the final resting place. I forget how deep it is. It's ludicrously deep. But that's where it is.
They found it.
Crazy. They have a bust, like a bust of Sir Ernest in Georgia. You know, like a memorial. Yeah. And I forget when Frank Worsley died. Sometime in the 90s at some point, like 96, like not 1990s, sorry, yeah, like yeah. 1960s or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry, yeah. That's
crazy story though, right?
That's absolutely wild. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean it almost had a happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah, it almost did have a happy ending, yeah.
Until the war, but yeah, like...
Exactly, yeah, the war kind of took away from it. But
it's interesting though, it's like, you know, they fought so hard and fought so long and did everything in their power to survive, but then we're just told, off you go.
Yeah.
Fight for England's glory. Go fight for your country now,
yeah.
Which is crazy.
Man wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success.
Well, that's what they went for, and that's what they got. Honor and recognition.
Madness.
Except for the carpenter.
That's so shitty.
He got honor, he just didn't get recognition.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Worsley as well didn't really get recognition.
No, he didn't. He shouldn't have.
Yeah. Should we name this episode Worsley's Expedition?
Yeah,
just right. Just a real FU to Shackleton.
The real hero of the expedition.
Yeah.
Is Frank Worsley. Like, yeah,
there you go.
There you go. Yeah, good. I'm glad I was able to take that to you today.
It surprised me how bad it got. Because you always hear about these things and it's like, yes, it's they're in dire situations and they survive and they make it through, and it's like, I don't mean to make little of the any of those incredible stories that we've talked about before, but it's like, man, they really went up against it constantly.
Yeah,
and I like the way there was like dynamic between the individuals on it, like certain people wanted to do different things, there was a mutiny, there was problems between them, but they did all stay together
at the end of it. That's why they I don't know how they stayed. That's what appeals to me so much about this story, is just the will of those men to survive and the fact that they never really drop their optimism all the time. I'd love to know if there's diaries or anything kept by the men who were left for the 128 days on Elephant Island.
I mean, the pictures from that photographer must be insane.
Yeah. Crazy.
Like 128 days? Just taking pictures of seagulls?
I'm pretty sure when Shackleton left the island, Elephant Island, with the other five men, he took most of the diaries actually and film with him, I believe.
Oh, at that point, to get it back.
In case those men never made it, or in case they couldn't make it back, I think that's what it was.
I was wondering this as well, because whenever they got there, obviously they needed to get a boat.
Yeah.
They needed to pay for that somehow. Like, so I wonder, is that what his plan was? I'll bring back the footage, I'll bring back the notes.
Yeah.
We'll sell the story so we can get the funds to go make, you know, get a rescue.
If or you have another, I mean, look, if you had to just listen to the whalers at the station in the first time, the Norwegian whalers, wait, it's too dangerous.
But this, that's not their nature, like, you know.
No,
like, their nature explorers. Is we're gonna go. You're telling us we shouldn't do it, but we're gonna go anyway, because that's what we do.
Such a crazy story, man.
Because people would say, don't go to the South Pole at all, fall asleep, because it's crazy.
I'd love to cover this story. I will cover the story someday. We will cover the story of Scott and his expedition, because that's another good one that also has quite a bleak ending.
Quite a bitter ending, yeah.
But still, you know, these are just interesting events of history. Like, you know, Fantastic human feats.
And where to find them.
There you go, yeah.
In bloody Hogwarts. The Whirler Sea. What was the sea called?
The Weddell.
The Weddell Sea.
Weddell Sea, yeah.
You can go see the endurance. Yeah. Go see it today.
Go see it today, yeah. God, it'd be so cold. All that kind of water freaks me out. All that polar water is just ice. Yeah. Imagine falling beneath that.
You're dead as soon as you're in it, basically.
God almighty, that's terrifying. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we hope this episode has found you well. This has been episode 129 of the Empty Promise podcast. Please do subscribe to the channel if you're not already a subscriber. You can find us over at youtube.com/emptypromisepodcast. If you're listening to this podcast where you can give us a rating or a like or whatever,
a thumbs up, anything.
I know if you listen on Spotify now, that there's a little rating or the top of Spotify that you can give.
Yeah,
just super quick, super easy, but it would help us out so much if you did that. That'd be excellent. And you can catch up with everything. What is it you can catch up with in the coming episode?
Oh yeah, we'll basically be doing our weeks, some news and just some general shooting the shit. What we usually do at the end of an episode, we're going to hit with a little episode in the middle of the week.
Exactly. So look out for episode 130 for that.
Yeah.
But we hope this episode has found you well. Thank you everybody for tuning in. We will see you all with another topic next week.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Goodbye and God bless.
Bye-bye.